So my name is Sheila, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
I'm
very grateful to be here. Stephanie, thank you for having me. Thank you for being patient with me as we shuffle dates and things. I'm really glad to be here. I don't know why I'm channeling summer so much. I forgot about June gloom in April, but I'm kind of a late bloomer in terms of menopause, and so I do have the occasional hot flash, so I'm sure I'm going to be, you know, taking the coat off, putting the coat back on, taking it back off. But so it works well for me. But I'm really glad to be here. And it, is it Garandi? Is that your name? The woman who greeted me when I came in? Anyway, Geraldine. I forget how simple it really is, just about being loving and welcoming. And it doesn't, at least for me, because I've been here a long time and in other fellowships a long time, and it never fails to amaze me how quickly that disease mentality, that ego, shows up. And I just feel out of sorts, or I feel like, you know, I'm showing up at a party that I wasn't invited to, or if I was invited, it was a reluctant invite or something like that. I mean, it's just amazing how consistently that happens. And I just have to remember, right, that I'll know that I'm in my disease or that ego if I feel unlovable, or there's something wrong with me, or I'm all alone, right? And those things come up like that, because for me, it was never about the weight, even when it was about the weight. And it certainly was never about tortilla chips or flour or whether I wham my food, whether I weigh and measure. It wasn't about any of those things. It was that spiritual malady that it talks about in the book. And that was me. And I think the biggest component of the spiritual malady and how it unfolded for me is not knowing my value. That's the worst thing I can do out in the world, is not know my value as a divine child of God. Because if I don't know mine, you don't have a shot. Just ask my husband. And so that's the work, right? And this isn't group therapy or anything like that. It's very concrete, 12-step work, grounded in a potential transformation, right? It's both a behavioral and a cognitive program. And I love both components of it. I love that it requires me to show up, and I love that it requires me to do the work. And then that transformation happens within, and it can't help but show up on my body. That's how it worked for me. And my top weight is 200 pounds. I came in February of 1988. At 200 pounds, and I weigh about 125 now. And I've never been at my top weight since, and I'm thoroughly convinced it's because of the direction I got in my first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, which was to work the steps, right? And then with my first sponsor, when it became clear that I just wasn't ready to feel the feelings, I just wasn't ready to cope with the fallout from having grown up in an alcoholic home. Both my parents were from alcoholic homes. So my parents weren't alcoholics, but their fathers were. And alcoholism travels south quickly. And my mother's alcoholic father was particularly problematic. He was a horrendously violent man. He wasn't just a child beater, he was a beater-upper. And my mother never got past it. She never did. She was a wounded bird for a lifetime. And I was the youngest. I was an unplanned pregnancy. And by the time I came along, because all my siblings, again, I'm the youngest of five, they were all much closer in age, following each other in school. Bam, 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 bam. And then she thought she had a break for a few years, and then she found herself pregnant again. And she was just done by the time I came along. She was done. And so I was left alone a lot. And that's how two men got their hands on me. So sexual trauma is part of my story, right? I was molested at 5 and at 10, a number of times at 5, and a few times, the more egregious one, at 10. And that's a huge, you know, that's a huge, again, a huge part of my story. And I'm very grateful to Overeaters Anonymous, because I'm also a, you know, a I started in Al-Anon in 86. I got clean and sober in 87 and turned to somebody 3 months in and said, can you have a problem with sugar like we do with alcohol? And she said, absolutely, go to Overeaters Anonymous. That's how I ended up here. And sugar was always my drug of choice, right? If you were to have lined up line of cocaine, a bag of good weed, a bottle of tequila, and carton of Marlboro Greens and a hot fudge sundae, I would have run to the hot fudge sundae. I still would. Hands down. But so I ended up in that meeting and met this wonderful woman who, she had just completed her doctorate in accounting at Michigan State University down the street from where I was, and I was in the seventh year of my four-year undergraduate degree at that same university. And she was at a really healthy body weight, and I asked her what this abstinence gig was, and she said, do you have a problem with a particular food? And I said, sugar, for sure. And she said, do you think it would be possible for you to not eat sugar today and just eat three meals? And I'm assuming the conversation went beyond that, and we would want it to, because you wouldn't want to send a newcomer out the door with that information, right? Oh, you got a problem with sugar? Just don't eat it. Three meals today. See you next week. Bye. But even if it didn't, the responsibility would be mine, because I knew how 12-step programs work. Because remember, I was in Al-Anon for 15 months at that point. I'm clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous with a couple of sponsors, because that's what I was directed to do, was get three sponsors, and I follow direction, right? I don't argue with people here. And so I knew how this gig worked. And it's really important for me to take responsibility. Because I was victimized so egregiously behind the sexual trauma, I'm really glad when I get empowered and get reminded here that if I don't have any responsibility, I don't have any power. And so within a couple of weeks, because I never saw that woman again, I ended up with a sponsor, and it was clear a few weeks in that I wasn't done with the quantity eating and I wasn't done eating sugar. Again, because I wasn't ready to feel the feelings behind growing up in that violent home. Nobody beat me in my home, but we got belted pretty good. And behind the sexual trauma. I just wasn't ready to feel those feelings. And I had a father who had three overweight daughters, and he didn't like that. He was very, he was very hurtful about that publicly. He'd say things out loud, very shaming things. And I got the worst of it because my two older sisters got a pass for various reasons. And so the man who should have been communicating to me that I was a beautiful little princess, as all little girls are beautiful little princesses and all boys are handsome princes on steeds, that's the message we all should have gotten. And perhaps I'm not the only one in the room who didn't get that message. I know I'm not the only person in the room who's dealt with sexual trauma. The statistics are just too high. And thank God for Overeaters Anonymous truly being on the vanguard in contrast to those other fellowships. You know, we put out that book, whatever that book is that they put out in 18 or 19 that deals with body dysmorphia and sexual trauma. And it's just a bunch of stories from people in Overeaters Anonymous. You know, my story is one of the stories in that book talking about how do you make your way back when you've dealt with this kind of stuff, right? And so again, I'm so grateful to Overeaters Anonymous for being on top of that. But again, it was clear I just wasn't ready to put down the food, quantity eating and sugar in particular. I have a filling in just about every molar in my mouth. And my sponsor said something that changed my life. And she said, work the steps regardless of what's going on with the food. Now again, this didn't make any sense to me given what I was dealing with in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But again, I don't argue with sponsors or cops. So when somebody says to me, this is how the game goes, I just play their game, right? Because I was out of gas when I got here. I just was. I was done. And I was also done being alone. I spent a lot of time alone as a kid. And so the idea that people welcomed me and loved me and were just telling me what to do, I'm all in. So I did that very thing. I just started working the steps. And my 12-step journey started in Michigan. I'm not a California girl. I'm a Midwestern girl. And we were largely influenced by the Alcoholics Anonymous of Bob Smith from Ohio. And Bob's theory was that you go through the steps over and over and over again, in contrast to Bill Wilson and the New York cohort, who felt like you were going to go through the steps one time. For a long time, Bill Wilson thought you only needed to do one four-step. And he reverses himself and talks about it in AA Comes of Age. But again, I knew that I was going to be going through those steps over and over again in a couple of programs, not in Al-Anon. It took me 20 years to get a sponsor in Al-Anon. I don't know why it took so long. I don't know why. Not 20, 15. Felt like 20. So I knew I was just going to be going through over and over again. So I got busy and did what that sponsor asked me to do. And within a couple of years, I weighed 180 pounds. So I'm 26 years old. Something is working, right? Because I've lost 20 pounds. I mean, I'm still overweight, still obviously overeating, but something's working. And I showed up at a family event, and my dad was there, and I walked by him, and he said, "Well, I can see you've lost some weight, but you got a lot more to go. Keep it up." And I turned around, and I said, "No more. That's it. It's over. We're done. It's over." And everybody kind of looked, you know, because nobody talked to my dad like that. I wasn't trying to be disrespectful. It was really just meeting fire with fire. But it was never appropriate for my dad to make those kind of comments to me. Right? And to his credit, he never said anything to me about my weight ever again and took responsibility and apologized. And now nobody can say to me that that's not recovery. Right? That I finally got to stand up to the bully. So I don't argue with people. Well, first of all, I argue with my husband, but I don't argue. As a general rule, I don't argue with people, but I definitely don't argue with people in 12-step programs because we're all hard-headed and we like to win. And when I'm arguing with you, you're not clear who's right and who's wrong. So, gosh, that was so much funnier in my head. But I just don't argue with people here. But there seems to be a big debate about whether or not you can work the steps in Overeaters Anonymous if you're still in the food. Now, how do you argue with somebody's esh? How do you argue with somebody's experience, strength, and hope? All I can tell you is that I kept working the steps year after year after year. Because I've been here, what? I mean, I came in 88. So I've been here 36 years. I only have 23 years of absence. I'll be 24 in a month or so. And so it took me a dozen years because I just wasn't ready to feel those feelings. But by the time I got abstinent in 2000, I weighed about 155, 160 pounds. So just in working the steps over and over and following direction, this wasn't my good idea. I was following direction, which is really good for me. And not because I'm a ruffian who needs to be tamed. Because I need to be lovingly cared for. You know, Michael knows this. He's a teacher. It's you want people to have high expectations of you. I am really grateful that I've always had sponsors who were very clear about what they wanted me to do for them. That changed everything for me. And so I don't participate in that discussion about whether you can work the steps, whether you're in the food. It's, you know, the whole idea of process addiction and conventional addiction, it's way above my pay grade. And you want to sit down, you want to have a fight, you want to pull out your big book and we're going to argue and you're going to tell me what Silkworth says and, you know, Harry Tebow and, you know, game on for you, not me. I'm going to sit there and just be quiet and say, gosh, I don't know how to tell you. This is just my experience. And if somebody wants to push it further and say, oh, no, you can't do that, and say, where's that in the conference-approved literature? Again, like, why are we fighting here? You know, there are wars going on all over the world. Why am I going to fight in 12-step programs about how it's supposed to go? How do I know? You think I'm going to stand in front of somebody and try and mandate what you're going to eat or what you're not going to do before you're going to work the steps? I don't know what anybody's dealing with. I'm not a healthcare professional. I'm not ready for that kind of fallout. I've heard stories here that would curl your hair in terms of fifth steps. And I'm probably not alone in that. And I just don't want to be the one to do that. I instead want to make it safe for somebody to start examining, to start dealing with what I think, perhaps you're going to find, I certainly have found, is the real problem. I don't have a weight issue. I didn't have a weight issue when I had a weight issue. I've always had a heart issue. And I'm very conscious about this with my words. I'm a writer. I know it's power. Your words have power. But I have to say the truth. The same two issues that I came in with are the same things I wrestle with now. I do not love easily, and I do not forgive easily. That's it. Every character defect I have harkens back to one of those two things. Because if it's not the guy who molested me, right, or it's the person not getting off the line quickly enough when the light turns green, right, I don't forgive you for you driving your vehicle the way you are choosing to drive your vehicle. You know, when you're sitting alone in your car and the light turns green, pedal on the right, pedal on the right, right? Like, let's go. What? What? So I stay very conscious about what is it I need to do so that I have full access to this. And anytime I'm convinced I'm right, I am so wrong. Even if I'm right, I'm wrong. It's really nice to be in that gentle place. And instead of saying, and I love resolution, right? I love kind of, you know, the whole thing like, no, here's what it is. That's fun. There's something that feels fun about that. But I think what feels fun about it is it feels familiar. Because it's off-putting. And it puts people at a distance. And there's still that diseased part of me that, you know, push-pull, you know, the clash. Should I stay or should I go, right? Both, right? I want you to stay, but be at a distance. You know, come closer. You know, I mean, my husband had to do that dance for a long time. You know, like, how close do I get to her? You know, is the steam coming off? That is no way to live. That's the problem. The food, the weight, that's the caboose of the train. That is so the caboose of the train. The problem is way ahead at the train, right? Those five engines that are dragging that 100-car train down the track. That's the issue. So I keep working the steps over and over again. I'm currently on the third step again and need it every time. I've done probably 50 or 64 steps, needed every single one of them, did one on my mother 20 years ago. Apparently, you know, take two. Right? That's where we are now, because that stuff's coming up again. And it's all just this wonderful unfolding. And I just want to make it safe here in Overeaters Anonymous. I want it to be a safe place for everybody. It's already unsafe enough out in the world to be overweight. It's the only prejudice, really, that's still actively sanctioned and allowed in society. You know, I remember I was on a Southwest plane, right? So you get to pick your own seats and stuff. And I was on my way going somewhere to lead an OA retreat, right? That makes this story particularly more relevant. And I'm sitting on the aisle seat because that's my gig. And then somebody's in the window seat, and there's a seat in between, and they've already announced that it's a full flight, right? So, you know, people are threading on. And the guy he's like in a business suit type guy. For some reason, I think he was an Orange County business guy. I don't know why I think that. He didn't say anything. He just read Orange County business guy. And he leans over to me and he says, hey, he says, help me out. Let's make sure that we don't get some fatty sitting in between us, right? Help me out. And I remember thinking, do I want to get in this? Do I want to get in the ring with this guy? And I just said, yeah. And if I didn't want to burn and hurt someone, it was tempting. Are you with me? Like, kind of just to wait for someone, some beautiful Zoptig woman, right? Because we're all beautiful. Has nothing to do with what we weigh. What's that quote from The Little Prince, you know? It is only with the, you know, nothing that is essential is visible to the eye. It is only with the heart that one can see rightly, right? I just wanted to burn this guy somehow. And just, obviously, you know, you don't do that. But I was heartbroken and furious at the same time. Because do you think he would have leaned over to me and said, hey, let's make sure. Do I just have five left? Yeah, I see you. Do you think he would have leaned over and said, hey, let's make sure we don't put somebody with a turban in, you know. Hey, let's make sure we don't put some, you know, don't put a black person between us. Don't put, you know, some Mexican. You think he would have done that? Of course he wouldn't have done that. But somehow he felt it was safe because he was a healthy body weight. I'm at a healthy body weight. He felt it was safe to lean over and tell me, don't put somebody who's overweight in between us. So if it's not safe to be overweight in the world, right? Saturday Night Live always used to have the overweight comedian, and then that one would die, and then they'd call up Second City or, you know, wherever, Groundlings, and say, send another fat comedian to New York, right? It's the only, they built sitcoms around overweight people, overweight men, not overweight women. And I just want Overeaters Anonymous to be a safe place for people, regardless of what they weigh. I just do. I don't care what anybody weighs. It's not my business. That all that tells me, if I'm sitting in a meeting and kind of assessing, how many years of absence? Really? You sure? If all that tells me is I belong in an Al-Anon meeting immediately, and that I'm off again, I've missed. It's here. The problem isn't out here. It's right here. And I just always want to stay very cognizant about that, because that's the only thing that gives me any peace, and it's the only thing that allows me to keep eating the way I'm eating. And it's essential that I eat that way. I deal with some health stuff. I can't show up in doctor. I can't, you know, I deal with a neurological thing, and then ended up with a scoliosis thing, kind of a neurologic thing. And I'm sure you're all praying people, right? I can only pray for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. But you can pray for my health and recovery. So get on it. And but it wouldn't work for me to put on weight. It just wouldn't work for me. It absolutely would not work for me. You know, I'm hanging on to that line in the big book on page 64. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically, right? So I have to, it truly is about my survival. And quite frankly, I think it is for a lot of us. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens behind, you know, being overweight in terms of, you know, we all know the gig. But the most important thing I can do is do what I can to make sure that Overeaters Anonymous stays safe for people. Because I do know this. It took me a dozen years of working the steps, showing up here, and I've never been a fringe player in 12-step programs, ever. I would always rather be the one who's doing too much and needing, you know, having a sponsor kind of grab me by the scruff of the neck and say, you know, rotation of leadership, you know, get out, right? Let someone else in. I'd much rather do that. But it took me years and years and years of doing that before I felt safe to be in a meeting and you know, sit with that abstinence, start accruing time, and start sponsoring people and letting myself be seen and seeing you and feeling those feelings, not just behind the violence and the trauma, but behind serious emotional attachment issues with a mentally ill mother whom I was spending the most time with because I was the youngest. Are you with me? Like, it all stacked up. Do you want to be the one standing in front of somebody and saying, hey, feel those feelings. Put that down. If you want to do that for yourself, and there are fellowships, and I respect those fellowships, because again, I don't argue with food fellowships either. And I don't want to mandate how anybody introduces themselves. I've got bigger problems than that. My husband still doesn't consistently put a napkin in his lap. I have bigger problems. So I want to remember what I think this is all about. It's all about, did you give me a stop talking sign?
Oh, you got 39 seconds.
Here we go. I just want to make sure that this stays safe and is a very loving place, because there's a lot of tender, tender hearts here in the room. And there are a lot more tender hearts outside the room, they don't even know it. And how much they need what we have to offer, you know? 12-step programs, I mean, it's really powerful what we do here. Though I still don't consider myself well enough to put a bumper sticker on my car, right? Because I'm just not going to put a bumper sticker on my car if, you know, the light turns green and I'm going to be in the car going like, you know, like flashing like gang signals, I guess. Like, what is this? You know, I mean, thank you. I just want it to be safe here. I just want to be in love, right? And, yeah, that's what I got. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. This is the time for questions only. There's no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leaders are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. And I will restate the question, and if I forget, you'll remind me to restate those questions. Okay, and we'll do this till 9:50. Please, Kat.
Thank you so much for your lead. Can you talk about the tools you use and if you have one that your favorite, like that you lean into the most?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the one that I lean into the most, Kat.
The question was.
Yep, very good. Thanks, Michael. See? So she asked about which of the tools that are most important for me that I lean into. And it is it's the outreach calls, because that was the hardest part. Mm-hmm. It was really, that was the hardest part. And ended up with a sponsor who required me to make 3 calls a day. And that was the hard, because it's that intimacy, you know, it's that emotional, spiritual, physical intimacy in my body of affairs that was the challenge. Yeah, so that's the one. Hey, Tusa.
You talked about forgiveness. Is it possible to fully forgive someone and choose, in your experience, and choose not to happen in your life, or is that not true forgiveness?
Oh, she asked, is it possible to forgive somebody and yet not have them in your life? It is in my world. And forgiveness is just the, I think it's the willingness to surrender the need to punish, I think. And the big thing with forgiveness for me was the men who molested me. And so they ended up on that first 4-step. And let's just talk about one. Let's just call him Marvin, right? Let's just say he's Marvin. And so I'm in that 4-column inventory, right? So I am resenting Marvin. And remember, resentment is just a $2 word for I don't forgive you, asshole, right? So I resent Marvin, molested me. Affects me in all these various areas, and it affected me in every area that is outlined in that book. And then I get to that magic 4th column, where am I selfish, dishonest, and fearful behind this resentment, behind not forgiving Marvin. And it's easy to see where you'd be fearful if you've been molested, so that's an easy box to check. It also talks about self-seeking, but self-seeking seems so aligned with selfishness. I just look for those 3. So fearful is easy to see. Where am I dishonest? Well, I don't forgive Marvin because he's on that resentment list. But I feel quite sure there are plenty of 4-steps out in the world that I've been on, right? I always say if I haven't ended up on my sponsee's 4-step, I haven't done my job as a sponsor, right? So there are certainly people whose forgiveness I need. And as my sponsor pointed out to me, is it then being dishonest to not forgive Marvin if I want forgiveness? I said, well, I didn't molest anybody. She said, that's not what I asked. Is there anybody who needs your forgiveness? You know, and do you need to get the forgiveness from someone else? And she pointed out, right, that it's that beautiful back and forth. So it was easy to check that box then. And then she talked about selfishness, right? And just said, is it selfish? Is the world missing out because of what Marvin did to you 15 years ago? And the world was indeed missing out. I was missing out. I made every man pay the price for what Marvin had done to me. And so I got I had a healing, right? And they got forgiven. And these were not men who were invited back into my life. And yet, interestingly, Marvin ended up, he was a family friend, and he ended up working in my dad's business, so I saw him all the time. Mm-hmm. And, but, yeah, I don't make qualifications. I mean, I've never had a husband who was a, you know, wife beater or anything like that. But that would certainly be somebody I would vote off the island and play the game here, because I'm not going to pay the price and lose everything because I want to stay mad at you, as though I'm punishing you if I'm not forgiving you. The only one who's getting punished if I don't forgive is me. But I'm certainly not going to keep a wife beater in my home, you know. So, yeah, I mean, those are spiritual questions way above my pay grade. But for me, it feels very comfortable to say, I love you, I forgive you, and I think we need to move in different circles.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hello. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thank you so much for your share. I wanted to ask, how have you forgiven your mom, and if so, how did you do that?
Yeah, this is a good question. I was just talking about this with my psychiatrist this week. Right?
And the question was?
Yes, thank you, Michael. Have I forgiven my mother, and is that to...
If so, how?
Yeah, if so, how? Again, I done... And tell me your name again.
Caroline.
Right, Caroline. Caroline was like, I didn't volunteer my name! you know, I'd done that four-step, you know, 20 years ago, Caroline. I was directed to do a four-step on my mother. Like, every line was, I resent my mother, resent my mother. And she said, you know, this is probably going to be hard for you. And I said, oh, no, it's not. And it felt like I had, you know, I really cleared some stuff out. And some things really, you know, came up as I had gotten older. I had gotten in the last couple of years, I got on a very radical diet that's dealing with this, you know, neurologic thing, because somebody who has it, a doctor who has it, you know, was in a wheelchair and is no longer in a wheelchair, and she's following a very radical diet. So I've started following that diet. So I lost like another 15 pounds, right? And I'm still at a healthy body weight. I, you know, have a registered dietitian, and she doesn't want me losing any more weight, and I won't. But all of a sudden, kind of that 15 pounds, which again, I was still at a healthy BMI, all that stuff, and, you know, and it looked fine, and all of a sudden there was no more buffer. So a whole host of things came up, and then really was giving me some real trouble, and that was why I sought out kind of, you know, more intense mental health support. And you know, my mother had real, you know, again, this isn't group therapy or anything, but I mean, she really was unattached to me, and you do real damage. And there was real damage done. I owe my life to 12-step programs. I'm thoroughly convinced I'd be sitting in a room rocking somewhere without them. So I am in that process. I'm right in the midst of that process of what this forgiveness is about. And what I know part of what it's about is it's the outreach calls. It's the writing. I do something that is recommended by another physician for people who deal with chronic pain, because I deal with chronic pain and have for years been, you know, and that it involves anger writing, and you do it twice a day, and you write, you know, just voraciously, you know, get it all out, say whatever you want, you know, nothing is you know, out of the game. You can use whatever language or whatever you want, and when you're done, you don't read it, you rip it up. And you throw it away, you rip it up, because they've done studies and determined that you change the neural pathways in the brain. So all of a sudden, you know, if you're writing about Jane who stole your guitar in eighth grade, and, you know, this, that, whatever about Jane, and then you rip it up, the next time you see Jane or you see somebody who looks like Jane, you might not think, or you might think, you shouldn't have done that, you silly girl, right? You change those. So I'm doing that kind of stuff, just following direction with my sponsor. And just also really remembering, my mother was just traumatized, you know? So it's a lot of times, it's a lot of going back and forth. You're so sweet. Every time I move, you move. So it's that whole process. So, you know, let's be outreach buddies. I mean, if you've got something, a forgiveness thing, and I've got a forgiveness thing, maybe we can help each other. You know, it's also that, like really finding our, you know, our compatriots here and just, you know, can you help me? I just, I think it's that. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Please.
Thank you so much. I stepped out for a second, so I hope I'm not repeating the question. When you are aggrieved in your day-to-day life by the husband about the napkin, et cetera, how do you bring yourself back to not going apeshit?
Yeah, well, usually I go apeshit and then, you know, make an amends. But, but no, I don't usually. But when I do, it's certainly good to know that there are those 10 steps, you know. Those, you know, spot check inventory 10 steps. And, but usually I have some, you know, between my programs, I'm in a meeting just about every day. Some, you know, and I mix it up. I do some live and Zoom stuff. So I've usually got something to do. There's all kinds of literature all over my house, all kinds of 12-step literature. So I might, you know, open up and read something. I'm trying to get into the regular, you know, back into a, you know, I had a very conventional meditation routine for a long time, you know, twice a day, a lot of minutes, you know, 40 minutes a day. And I, you know, fell off that beam and have been trying to get back with that. That would be really useful for me. But the biggest thing is, and it's also really the hardest thing, just stop talking. Just don't, you know, just stop talking. If I can just not respond, and what I do is I imagine I have a deceased sponsor and a, you know, couple other people in my, you know, who are deceased who mean a lot to me, and sometimes I'll think of them and I'll just say to them what I want to say to my husband, or, you know, say to whomever isn't doing what I think they should be doing. But it's a whole host of things. It's also just being, it's this, like this conversation will be part of it. I'm sure the next time, right, and it's probably happening at 7:30 tonight, right, I might even think of this conversation and just remember this question, you know, just like, just find the way. Just remember, it's all right here. You know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Thanks. What was your spiritual journey like?
The spiritual journey continues. I was raised Catholic, and I love Catholicism. I'll always be a Catholic girl, but I'll always be a Buddhist. I'll always be a Sikh. I'll always be a Hindu. I'll always be a Jew. I'll always be, right? All of it, right? One God, many paths. And love them, serve them, feed them. And so it's been that kind of that progression. But I had a lot of fear around God, again, because of the, you know, trauma and the disconnection from my mother. And so that has been a real journey. I found myself in another spiritual community that is, you know, very similar to, again, what we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, one God, many paths. And just love the differences, love all of it. You know, I live in a very diverse neighborhood. I sought that out. Being in the midst of that exploration. And I still have some of those fears come up. I deal with I also have a spiritual counselor that I talk to. He's, you know, a former priest. And so he's kind of helping me with some of that old Catholic stuff. And quite frankly, I think I'm helping him with some of his old Catholic stuff. But it's just that exploration. And when in doubt, I just default to, and this is what I got to. This was kind of an interesting one with my mom, is the psychiatrist had asked me, you know, I see him on Thursday nights for a 2-hour session. And he said, do you think your mom is evil? And I said, oh, no, no, no. And I kind of went on, you know, for a minute or two, you know, a few minutes. And he later said, he said, you know, I was really surprised to hear how voraciously you asserted that your mom's not evil. I said, yeah, I don't believe anybody's evil. I don't, you know, no, I don't. I believe that people are in profound amounts of pain sometimes. And I wonder sometimes if somebody's going to catch it on this round or if they need to transition to the next round before some of that stuff can open up. But no, I don't. And that was a real watershed moment for me. Because, again, my mother did completely different things with me than she did with my older sisters. And it, you know, through no fault of my own, I'm glad I'm here, but I didn't make this happen. I didn't pick that sperm and that egg and say, you know. So it's just random that this went this way. And I forgive my mother. So if I can, and I forgive the men who molested me, and I listen to 4 steps from men in Alcoholics Anonymous because I sponsor men and women, and I've listened to 2 men's 4 steps, men who molested little girls. I listened to their 5 steps, and I saw them with the eyes of love. That's what we do here. So if I can forgive in that way, do I really think God wouldn't forgive me for my pain and drama? Like, that was a really big moment for me, you know? And so it's just this wonderful exploration, just being in it. There's a great quote in the Bible, it's Old Testament, and it says, I believe. Please help my unbelief. Like, it's all true, you know? And, yeah. Great. I think that's it, right? Awesome.